the feel of it. The soul touch she gave me, the way her words clutched at some dark and secret place inside of me. She had a way of saying almost nothing, but when she did speak, her words radiated with truth and power. I looked forward to the visits. I didn't even mind the dudes I had to go around or ride past in silence to get there, or her brothers. For Viviana, I would have done anything. One night, we kissed and kissed, then found ourselves unable to stop. Until then, we did nothing more than fondle and linger in easy talk, but something snapped between us. This unseen barrier, which often kept us at a distance, despite being so close there, appeared to break. Our inhibitions were freed and my hands groped her supple body as her tongue freshened the inside of my ear. I gently pushed her down on the porch, and she followed willingly, eagerly. Her rising rate of breathing gave way to moans and sighs and women sounds that called forth a measure of something sweet and taut within me. My hand moved to the top of her pants, where a button had been loosened, and I pushed my hand through and found I could go all the way to the stem of her pleasure, to the silkiness of her vagina, while she squirmed and tightened and squeezed as I felt myself swimming, drowning in the ocean of our lovemaking. The moments dripped. Then Viviana exploded in a rush of orgasms. I rocked next to her like a baby in a cradle. Suddenly, the porch, the trees, the walkway and row of houses became intruders. An uncomfortableness crept around us. Viviana sat up, buttoned her blouse and pants, then placed her hands to her face and sobbed. "What's the matter, baby?" I whispered. "You have to leave," she said, between her fingers. "Why?" "I can't explain. Just leave, please." "I don't see why. Let's just sit here and..." "Louis, you don't understand nothing, do you?" she said. Her attitude a sharp contrast to the moments before, almost as if those moments were just dust from dreams, which often appeared real, but only dust. "All right, baby, all right. I'll go." I stood up and pulled the bike up from the grass. I felt so dumb, unable to find words, some sentences which could ease the pain, anything. "I'll be back, Viviana," I mustered while on my way out. "Don't ever forget what happened here tonight." She laid her head on her arms, which were on top of her knees as she sat on the porch steps. "Go, please, just go," were her last words. Viviana failed to return my calls. Deep, hoarse voices answered the phone and said, "She's not here." I wrote Viviana letters, but doubted the wisdom of sending them. At night, I woke up suddenly, after dreaming of her coming to me, embracing me and dancing. And when I sat up, I struck the walls, grasped the pillow, and cried out her name. Some nights, I rode my bike to her house and stared from across the street. Windows darkened, porch light out. I felt like running up the steps and banging at the screen door and yelling for her to come out, but I could never do this. I hoped she would slide open the curtain, feel me near her, that she would let me in. Viviana never looked out that window. She never opened the door. A month or so passed, and I went to another dance at the El Monte Legion Stadium with my sisters, Shorty and Anna. As usual, the place was jam-packed with vatos and rucas from barrios all over the San Gabriel Valley. Lowriders graced the rows of cars in the parking lot. Different gang members exchanged hand signs and spray-painted the names of all their homeboys on the walls. This was a huge hall. I rambled around looking at the people, feeling like shit, but still open to make the most of the evening. Then my heart jumped. Viviana was there, at a seat by herself. I walked fast to get to her, but before I did, some dude came out of nowhere and offered her his hand to dance. She accepted. King Gao, I just missed her. My palms were wet, my tongue dry. I felt like there was an oven in my chest. Then Viviana returned, and this time I sat down next to her. "Baby, how are you doing?" I said. She turned her head, looked at me, and smiled. God, it felt good. She acted coy, diffident, but alluring. There wasn't much to say. I leaned over and kissed her, and she then placed her hand to the back of my neck, and I felt her moan and squirm in her seat, taking me back to that night on her porch. We kissed a long time before she gently pulled me away. "Prieto, I need to do something. Will you wait here?" Viviana requested with her hands on my chest. "Sure, I ain't going nowhere." She got up from the seat. Her hands brushed her dress over the curb of her hips and then walked out. I felt so much relief. Love leapt out of my ears. Viviana, Viviana, how I prayed to every god known to man for this moment. I sat there for an hour. Viviana didn't show. Others were being coupled already. Slow dance after slow dance caused me great anxiety. Where was Viviana? I looked around, but wouldn't leave the seat. It took me longer than most, but it finally hit me. She wasn't coming back. I stepped away from that spot, walked through the sweat and cologne, through the stale smoke and wine breath. I made it to the exit. Then Viviana appeared in a darkened corner, making out with another guy. By the time I caught up with Shorty and Anna, I was wound up, bumping strangers, talking loud, challenging everyone. A dude would give me any kind of look, and I pushed myself up on him. "What you looking at, puto?" "Louis, come on, let's go," Shorty said, pulling me away. "Forget it, man." I told my sisters what happened with Viviana. I wanted to kill someone. To help lessen my anger, Shorty and Anna plotted to wait outside of the Almighty Legion for Viviana and Jumper. "We'll do it for you, bro, okay?" Shorty said. At first, I liked the idea. I stood outside by my sisters as the place closed up and crowds of teenagers streamed to the parking lot. But the sadness and anger, which first overwhelmed me, soon started to choke me. All I wanted to do was get the hell out of there. "Forget it, man," I told my sisters. "I don't want anything to happen to Viviana. Let's go home." It was over. Finally over. Mr. Madison looked tense, sitting there in short-sleeved shirt and casual slacks. In front of him were about 20 teenagers from Lomas, lying around in a circle on the front yard of my homeboy Alex's house. Mr. Madison had been persuaded to meet with us about how to improve the conditions at Mark Keppel High School. "As principal of your school, I plan to make this the best learning experience of your lives," he said. "But no one man or administrator can do anything unless you decide to put everything behind it." He seemed to be open, willing to consider our ideas. Chent had told me to give him the benefit of the doubt, but not to let him off the hook either. Chanta didn't want us to be given the runaround or peas without real educational advances. But he said the students had to play the leading role in ensuring those advances were realized. I can't make any guarantees, Mr. Madison said to finish the meeting. The wheels of progress turn slowly, but I will promise to do all I can. If you work with me, I'll work with you. He got up and shook everybody's hand. The next school year, I was allowed to come back. Chicanos made up almost 40% of the student body at Keppel, although it seemed like it was 80%. The dark faces under the tree on the lawn, the daily brawls among us, and police coming through the hallways made it seem like nobody but Chicanos attended the school. The Anglo students plugged along among their own, isolated in the upper floor classrooms. They were in the journalism club that put out the school newspaper, ironically called the Aztec. They were in school government sessions making decisions about pep rallies, the annual Christmas party, and the prom. They made up the school teams, the cheerleading squads, and most ironically, they were the school mascots, Joe and Josephine Aztec. The mascots were always Anglo, cloaked in deerskin, Indian-like garb. They usually acted like clowns, tripping over each other during football games while rallying the team to victory. Sometimes they did tumbling acts, nothing whatsoever to do with being Aztec. The Chicanos started their own student club called Tomas to help Mexican-American students. The other high schools in the district also did the same. San Gabriel High School had MASO, Mexican-American Student Organization, and Alhambra High School had Juntos, which means together. My first few days back in school, I felt like an outsider again. There seemed to be more activity, though. I saw some Chicanas dressed in pep squad gear, and a few Chicanas were members of the journalism club. The strict demarcation between the whites and Mexicans in some areas appeared to be breaking down. I spent a lot of time in between classes at the Chicano Student Center, which was an office and lounge space in a bungalow in the middle of the school next to the lunch benches. Mrs. Baez was the homeschool coordinator, a woman who lived in Rosemead's South Side, a mother of teenagers and active in Chicano affairs. She was also on the board of the Bienvenidos Community Center. Mr. Perez, the print shop teacher, was the club's advisor. Two college students were hired as part-time assistants. Blanca Glendon, a Chicano married to a black, and Carmela San Juan, who was part Mexicana and part Filipina. Tomas meetings were held once a week. At the first meeting, dues were paid, officers elected, issues of concern raised, and activities planned. The most significant of our activities then were the Cinco de Mayo festivities, including our own float and the annual observances and efforts to raise funds like holding dances. At first, the club concerned itself only with benign aspects of school life. But the body realities and the long-standing issues of inequality and neglect kept rearing their heads. During the meetings, I kept quiet in the corner, not volunteering for anything, until something I didn't know what would snag my attention. Mrs. Baez, come outside, a student shouted through the door of the Chicano Student Center. There's a fight. Mrs. Baez left the paperwork she was working on and quickly followed the student outside. Bam Bam and another student, Alfredo, were going at it in the courtyard. Before this, the school administration would have automatically suspended or expelled the students. Mrs. Baez now could intervene and tried to work out the problems among the Chicanos before the school staff got involved. This meant a lot of gray hairs for Baez and her assistants. I sat in the lounge area, my hair long and slicked back, with a couple of other students. Blanca opened the door and asked us to step out for a time so a student session could be held. Mrs. Baez brought in Bam Bam and Alfredo and had them sit. I walked out and looked back through the window as an intense argument ensued between Bam Bam and Alfredo, with Blanca and Mrs. Baez trying to work out some solution. This is what they had to deal with every day. The leading members of Tomas were mostly women, among them Esme, Chacha, Amelia, Ivan, and Flora. A few dudes helped, such as Isidro, Alex, Chuy, and myself. But the women ran everything. It was through Tomas and through the example of Mrs. Baez, Blanca, and Carmela that the women from Lomas found a place to address some long-standing grievances. Their leadership found shape and form through Tomas as they took to heart the battle for their respect and that of their people. We dealt with two dominant aspects. One was something called Project Student, with Carmela as our sponsor, which targeted the physical deterioration of the school. Walls were cracked, stairwells in disrepair, and the freeway behind the school drowned out lessons from second floor classrooms. In the summer, the air conditioning system rarely worked, making for long, sweltering days. In the winter, rain accumulated in buckets from roof leaks. Project Student, in fact, involved more than just Chicanos. Whites and others also had to endure these conditions. The other aspect involved the issue of dignity for the Chicano students. "You don't mind if I don't call you Chin, do you?" Mrs. Baez asked. "Chale, what's up?" "We'd like to propose you and Esme try out for Joe and Josephine Aztec." I looked over at Esme and then back to Mrs. Baez. "You're joking, right?" "We're very serious," Esme said. "We're tired of them patties, excuse me, but them Anglos putting down our culture. They make the mascots look like Pocahontas with tomahawks and then prance around like fools." "That's true, but what are our chances? I mean, how are we going to win when the Anglos do all the judging?" "We plan to do an authentic Aztec dance. An authentic Aztec dress," Esme said. "If they deny us, then everyone will know how racist the school is." "But I don't know any Aztec dances." "We have somebody willing to teach you," Mrs. Baez said. "He's an instructor for a folklorico dance troupe at one of the colleges. You look Indian enough with your long hair, and I think it would help involve some of the hardcore Loma students in what we're doing if you try it out." "What do you say, Louis?" Esme asked. They knew they had me. I accepted it as a formality. Esme and I went to East LA College and met with a Señor Franco, the folklorico dance instructor. He taught us some basic steps and helped us find the material and designs for our dance wear. To get it right, we dedicated hours of our evenings to rehearsal. Esme choreographed the dance routine based on Señor Franco's instruction. Our mothers created the costumes, and they were so strikingly beautiful, even Señor Franco was impressed. We added some non-Aztec touches, too. The rehearsals were secret. When the time neared for the tryouts, we walked into the activities office and signed up. A couple of white students there gave us funny looks. Esme and I signed our names and then left. The day of the tryouts, all contestants were to meet in the gym. Parents, teachers, and students took up some of the bleachers. A row of judges, including some teachers and students, stayed near the performance area. I entered the gym area in elastic dress. I had on a leather top, armbands, and loincloth, with a Jaguar image headgear propped on my head and bell strapped around my ankles. And I must have been a sight with tattoos on my arms and an earring. I saw a couple of rows of bleachers filled up with Chicanos. Mrs. Baez had organized the students to attend. As I entered, they cheered and hollered. I considered getting out of there, but Esme came up behind me and held my hand. We were both nervous. Esme and I were the last ones to perform. We suffered through a number of tumbling acts and screwball routines. Then an announcer came on the speaker. Now we have the team of Esmeralda Falcón and Luis Rodriguez. Silence saturated the gym area. I walked up solemn and straight, a wooden chair in one hand and a conga drum in the other, and sat down in the middle of the basketball court. I paused for 10 seconds, then began the beat. Esme came in slow, purposeful, with a turquoise, sequined, and feathered garment, and multicolored headgear that arced around her head like a rainbow. She also had bells. Esme could have been a priestess from Tenochtitlan. Her face, pure and brown, with slight makeup that accented her already slanted indigenous eyes. She danced around me, as if calling forth a spirit, the bells on her ankles swirling around the beat, in time with the rhythm of the drum. At one point, I arose and danced with her, in unison, round and round, through various steps, leading up to the climax. We had to be serious, no laughing, no smiling, in keeping with the integrity of the dance. A murmur swept through the bleachers when Esme and I crossed our feet together and swung around and around, hooked by our ankles, going faster and faster, the force of our swirling keeping us locked, letting the motion pull and embrace us at the same time, like in a battle. When we finished, one of my knees fell to the floor as Esme stood above me, the victor. A few seconds passed, then an uproar of applause and cheers burst out of the bleachers. None of the other contestants received the response we did. I even saw white students and some judges clapping. They had never seen anything like it. Esme and I waited by Mrs. Baez as the judges mulled over their decision. Finally, the winners are, and the new Joe and Josephine Aztec mascots of Marquepa High School, Esmeralda Falcón and Luis Rod. The yells drowned out my last name. Esme shrieked, threw her arms around my neck and hugged me. Other Tomas supporters came over with smiles and handshakes. In other people's eyes, this may have been a small victory. But for the Chicanos at Marquepa High School, this meant another barrier had been torn down and an important aspect of our culture recognized. I surprised myself and felt warm inside. I tried to shake it off, but couldn't. A flush of pride soon covered my face. We won. More Chicanos became involved in Tomas. We started our own folklorico group in which Carmen San Juan taught the students some basic Mexican and flamenco dances. Esme and I started a teatro group based on what the Teatro Campesino of Cesar Chavez's Farm Workers Union were doing in rural California. Our teatro group, however, had an urban slant. I wrote the three plays we performed. One involved a dramatic verse monologue of a Chicana about to be arrested by the cops. Another involved a one act about being proud of our culture. But the most controversial one dealt with getting Lomas and Sangra to stop fighting each other. This play began with someone from Sangra crossing out Lomas on a huge piece of white paper pasted on a wall. Then the action moved toward a point when the dudes from both neighborhoods go at each other. The upshot is as the two barrios fight, local government officials are on the side, determining the site of a new mall or where the next freeway will go, while making plans to uproot the very land the dudes were killing each other for. "Who wants to play the dude crossing out Lomas?" I asked. Nobody raised their hand. "What's the matter? It's only a play." "Hey, Louie, we ain't about to cross out the hills," Chewy said. "I know what you're trying to say, but somebody might get hurt." I decided to play this part. I had to stand by my play. We presented the productions at a joint culture event sponsored by Tomas, Maso, and Juntos. That day, a large grouping of dudes from Lomas came by and sat in the back. They acknowledged me, but I had to go through with the play. When we finished, a few dudes stormed out yelling, "Lomas Rifa!" But for those who stayed, we discussed ending the warfare between the barrios. Then, Esme's portrayal of the Chicana getting beaten by the cops in rhymed verse helped keep the spirits high. The wheels of progress turned too slowly. While we kept up with Tomas' activities, the school could not keep up with all the students' needs. Red tape and outright opposition stalled Project Student. Then one night, a group of white kids broke into the school and spray-painted the walls surrounding the Chicano Student Center with stuff such as, "Mexicans, go home! Greasers stink! Remember the Alamo!" Esme called a meeting to determine what should be done. "We should draw up some demands," Amelia suggested. "That's right. People are still prejudiced here," said Flora. "Well, what do we ask for? They've given us a lot so far. What can we get that we don't have already?" Esme asked. "I got an idea," I said. Chente over at Bienvenidos took me to the East LA schools. After the blowouts, they got more Chicano teachers and even Chicano studies. "This is what we need. We should demand a Chicano studies class and a Chicano teacher." "Maybe Mr. Perez will teach it," Amelia said. "Or even Mrs. Baez. It's a great idea." "How many are for it?" Esme said. It was unanimous. The next day, we presented our plans to Mrs. Baez. I wrote up a statement with the heading, "We demand justice." The statement called for the school to find the culprits who defaced the Chicano Student Center, for more Chicano teachers, and for a Chicano studies class. But Mrs. Baez didn't like it. "Why? If we don't do something, the Gabachos will try to roll back the little we've got," I said. "I think it's too rash," Mrs. Baez implored. "You don't know the kind of trouble you can get into. I know Chente has introduced you to a lot of the East LA student leaders, but this is not Garfield High School. We are a minority in the school. We have to do things differently. We can't just act like anybody should give us anything." "But the Chicanos in this school have been pushed around for too long," Esme said. "We're tired. Every time we try to better ourselves, we're told to wait, to hold on, that things will get better. But it never does. We have to do something. We have to do it now." "I can't support this," Mrs. Baez said. "But you do what you feel you must." "We can't do it without you," Flora said, "and you know it." Then Flora walked out. Disappointment crossed over everyone's faces. Defeat seemed to set in. But Flora's actions gave me another idea. Why not have a school walkout like they did in East LA? Our demands would be for Chicano studies, more Chicano teachers, and the new classrooms, air conditioners, and repairs needed as part of Project Student. It would be a walkout for our self-respect. The word spread. Esme and the others made sure everyone talked to everyone else. Only the Chicanos were involved. I discussed with Chente what we planned to do. He wasn't sure a walkout was a good idea, but he was willing to help us out. He ran off mimeographed copies of our demands. The next day, everyone went to school like normal. At 10 a.m., the students were to walk out of their classrooms and assemble in front of the school. "Do you think they'll do it, Louis?" Esme asked, while on our way to classes that morning. "I don't know, but we'll soon find out." In my history class, I kept an eye on the clock. As soon as the hand struck the magical hour, I grabbed my books and then proceeded out the door. "Rodriguez, where do you think you're going?" Mrs. Tuttle said, the one we called Mrs. Turtle and who treated us like we were in kindergarten. "Young man, come back here this instant." But I kept on walking. In the hallways, a number of students emerged out of their classes. Not a lot, but more than I had imagined. Books were dropped in the hallways. When I made it to the front steps of the school, there were already 80 to 100 students converging there. Esme and the other Tomas members had made crudely painted signs and gave them to the students. I grabbed a handful of the demands from a bag and passed them out. Some of the students came up and grabbed stacks of the leaflets to help get them to other students. In a matter of minutes, we had some 300 people on the front lawn. Teachers and those students still in classes stuck their heads out of classroom windows. Mrs. Baez received a phone call from Mr. Madison. "Did you know this was going to happen?" Mr. Madison said. "No, I didn't know about a walkout." "I discouraged them, however, from presenting their demands," Mrs. Baez explained. "And you refused to inform me about this?" Mr. Madison yelled. "You're supposed to tell me what's going on. That's why we have you here." "Oh, I wasn't aware of this," Miss Bias said, her voice also rising in anger. "I thought I was to be here for the students, so they can have someone to talk to and represent their interests. I didn't know I was supposed to be your eyes and ears." "Mrs. Bias, come into my office right now. We're going to have to put a stop to this," Mr. Madison said and hung up. When Mrs. Bias showed, Mr. Madison stood up, getting ready to do some more yelling, but Mrs. Bias interrupted him. "Mr. Madison, you can stop right there. I am a grown woman and a mother. I am not one of your high school students. I refuse to have you talk to me in this disrespectful and condescending tone." "Oh, you too," Mr. Madison said. "Everybody wants respect around here. What about respect for me and this institution? We have a school to run. I can't have the school board find out about this. I can't let some disgruntled students ruin it for everyone. I would suggest that you pay attention to those disgruntled students and stop worrying about what the school board would do," Mrs. Bias said. "You've promised these children some action. So far, all they've received is a lot of fine talk and smiling faces. I don't support their tactics, but I believe the worst thing to do now is to sweep this under the rug. I won't be a part of that." Mr. Madison looked stunned. His homeschool coordinator had turned the tables on him. But he knew, whatever he thought of her, she was still his link to the students. "Okay, we'll let them have their say." Mr. Madison sat down and made a phone call to the Dean of Students, Mr. Walsh. We're calling an assembly, Mr. Madison said. I want those students back into the school. And then we'll hear what they have to say. But we won't begin to talk unless they're inside the school building. Mr. Walsh came out to the lawn. The students had been chanting, "We want Chicano studies! We want justice! Ya basta!" It took some doing, but Mr. Walsh convinced us to convene in the auditorium and discuss the issues. "Bring in the whole school," I yelled. "You can't separate us. We want to speak to the whole school." At first, they refused. But finally, when it looked like the students weren't going to budge, Mr. Walsh agreed to let all the classes gather in the auditorium. It was a session the likes of which Mark Heppel had never seen. Esme walked up to the stage and read out the demands. White students also stood up, some in tears, crying about why we were so angry. "What have we done to you?" one blonde-haired girl demanded to know. Some Chicano students yelled back about being neglected, treated like second-class citizens, about being denied access to school resources. "This is not against whites," I said. "It's against a system that keeps us all under its thumb. By screwing us, the school is screwing you." "It's your fault," said Stan, the student body president. "You Mexicans just don't want to get involved. You don't want to get ahead." More yelling, more heated responses. It was difficult, but this had to happen. Everything had stayed bottled up for too long. Each group doing their own thing, complaining about the other group, but not reaching out. The tears, the yelling, the talk served as good medicine for all the students. Even some hard-nosed dudes got up to say something. Some of them had never spoken out in public before. Near the end, I stepped on the stage and made a speech. "Chicanos only want what you want," I said. "We walk these halls together, and yet we don't know anything about each other. We're scared of each other. We're ignorant of each other. And then we're surprised when people get up like this with so much hatred. It's for a reason. There's nothing wrong with us. We're not just making this up. Something drastic has to change, or there's going to be even more anger, more than you can imagine." The result, Mr. Madison approved a new course, a class on Chicano history and culture, and he offered to provide a Chicano teacher for the class. Finally, he said the school would put some meat behind Project Student. It became a school-backed initiative to present to the school board. Esme and I hugged again. We had only just begun. Shorty's eyes fell. Her voice cracked, and tears blurred her vision. "He's dead, Mama," she said. "Quién?" Mama asked. "Quién se murió?" "Fernando. He killed himself last night." 14-year-old Fernando Luna had been one of Shorty's best friends. He was a member of the Lomas Dukes, the younger set the United Sisters usually partied with. He called himself Gallo, which means rooster. His older brother was Lencho, who was more involved in the affairs of the hills than Fernando would ever be. Fernando was one of those guys who tried hard to belong, to be as crazy and committed as anyone. But none of us were aware how lonely he was in the midst of the crowd. His mother, Toncha, was active in the Bienvenidos Food Co-op. But as a single mother on welfare, with five boys to raise, Toncha's hands were full. And, I'm sure through no fault of her own, Fernando's needs weren't always met. Shorty had been seeing a few of Fernando's homies, like Bosco and Conejo. And although she confided with Fernando many of her problems, they never became intimate. She saw him as a good friend, somebody she could talk to. Now it comes out, Fernando liked my sister very much. The night before, Fernando had phoned late to talk with Shorty. Usually she was full of stories, jokes, and concerns. But Shorty was in bed and tired. She gently suggested he call her back the next day. Or let's talk at school, she said. We can get together at lunch. Sure, okay, Fernando responded. There was nothing unusual in his tone. The next day, Doncha discovered Fernando's body swinging from a pole in the closet. It's not enough to accuse, to wail, and spit on the face of all oppression. This can be ignored, Skin said. It takes a scientific approach to uncover the source of exploitation, to unravel society's delicate and intricate tapestry, stitched with the skin of our mothers, the bones of our ancestors, the blood of all who toil. This is why we can demand, with full authority, what has been stolen from us, Ophelia said. And this they cannot ignore, Skin added. Another session with the collective. Most of it held in an eloquent and educated Spanish. I could not speak myself, yet I grasped everything being said. The group aimed to train a core of leaders. Unlike others in the Chicano movement, who strove to enter the American capitalist system, it prepared for a fundamental reorganization of society. It's also time you understood whites aren't the enemy, Chente said. Take that tradition, all that energy expended against each other. What a waste. Others with their own answers also converged on the barrio. Born-again Christians, many of whom were ex-cons and ex-junkies, preached salvation. I attended some of their testimonials. Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, and Nationalists also plied their wares. Some wanted our minds. Some wanted our souls. Some wanted warm bodies for polling booths. But the collective didn't depend on powers of belief or stale promises. They were social scientists, all the time probing and summarizing. You don't have to be a genius to figure out what's in front of you, Chente said. Yet, this is the hardest thing to do, precisely because what we see is not always expressing what's beneath it. But all we know is this life, I questioned. You can't change that. Luis, change is what we're all about, Chente offered. Change is constant, stagnation is relative, but change follows laws of development, a process that, if appreciated, sets the conditions by which people make their own history. What we're here to do is transform the way people have been accustomed to living, Sergio said. The first step is removing the shackles on our minds. The collective explained how workers of all colors and nationalities, linked by hunger and the same system of exploitation, have no country. Their interests as a class respect no borders. To me, this was an unconquerable idea. I also learned there was no shame in being a janitor or a garment worker. I never looked at Mama and Dad with disdain again. So fundamental, so Christian, so American at times. Yet this conflict would be the most intense and prolonged of our lives. A party below the hills swung with music. Ruquitas de aquellas and anything to get high with. Suddenly, this dude Rudy rushed into the living room, breathing hard and sweating. Where's Santos and Tuch? He demanded. What the fuck you want? Santos yelled from the kitchen. The gabachos on Marshall Street tried to jump me, man. Slow down. What happened? I was walking my girl home when the bikers from that old gray house, you know, the one before you get to the church. Anyway, They come out of the house with chains and bats, call us fucking greasers, and chase us down the street. I know who they are. They're in a biker's club, the Sinisters, Toots said. Fuck 'em, Santos responded. Let's get them white boys. A caravan of three cars pulled out of the party toward Marshall Street on the other side of the freeway. I piled into a vehicle so packed, two dudes were stuffed into the trunk. I could hardly breathe the whole way up there. The gray house had been known as a biker's hangout for years. The grassless yard filled with automobile and motorcycle parts. Real poverty row. When we arrived, dudes piled out of the cars and began to attack the white picket fence, tearing off sections of it and yelling out, "Here stand las Lomas!" A rock smashed a window. A long-haired, leather and denim-clad dude stepped onto the porch, cradling a shotgun. He fired and Pokey received some of the pellets in his face, and he dropped to the street. Dudes began to run in all directions. Many jumped back into their cars. I ran off too, and came across Santos with a knife. He started poking me and a couple of others with it. "You don't fucking run," he yelled. "Lomas never runs." But in the confusion, there was nothing else to do. Toots and Cuadro picked up Pokey to take him to the hospital. I got into somebody else's car, and we boogied back to the party. Later at the party, Santos gathered all the dudes together and again shouted about the cowards we were. Puppet had heard what happened and called the house. But Puppet was pissed off we went after the bikers. He said nobody but nobody was to go back there. Santos wasn't having it. Toots, Cuervo, and I will go in one car, he said, displaying a handgun through his pants belt. Chin, you get a couple of other dudes and come by 5 minutes after we do. Can you get a cuete? Simon, I think so. Órale, then do it, and follow us over there. I knocked on Roger Nelson's window. He opened it. Roger was a half-Mexican, half-white guy who I knew had weapons. What you want, Chin? It's 2:30 in the morning. I need a rifle, man. Anyone you got? What's going on? I explained the situation to him. Roger knew the Sinisters. In fact, they were longtime enemies. The Sinisters hated Mexicans. They also hated Roger because, although he looked white, he decided to cleave closer to his Mexican side and spent a lot of time with dudes from the hills. Roger handed me a Ruger Long 22 semi-automatic rifle with scope. "Bring it back in the morning. I'll take care of it for you," he said. I took a dude from the Imperial's car club named Dario, who had a sharp, cherried-out Riviera. This was my first mistake. My second mistake was taking Conejo from the Dukes. He was my sister's ex, a 13-year-old who was eager to go with me, so I figured it wouldn't hurt. We were supposed to follow the old beat-up car that Santos and the others were in. But by the time I got everything together, they were long gone. I told Dario to drive slowly down Marshall Street. As we approached the gray house, it looked like a tornado hit the place. The bikers were scrambling about outside. A couple of bodies were on the ground. Dario pulled up, and I stuck the rifle out the side window. "They're back!" a woman yelled. The bikers rushed around. Some jumped over trash cans and others tripped into the dwelling. I didn't know what to do. A massive biker dude stood nearby on the yard and looked at me while he tried to figure out his next move. But instead of running, he turned around, wound his arms over his head, and bent over. Without thinking, I shot him. Right in the ass. "Take off, man, take off," I yelled at Dario. We sped off toward Delmar Avenue, not far from my house, but we didn't get too far. Police cars came out of nowhere from every direction. Darío stopped the car in the driveway of an apartment complex. "Come out with your hands up," a cop yelled. We did as they ordered. I emerged from the car, and perhaps 10 38 caliber revolvers were pointed at my head. They told us to lie on the ground with our hands on our heads. I saw a cop reach into the back seat of the car and carefully remove the .22 rifle with his fingertips. "I got it," he declared. Conejo cried the whole time we were hauled to the San Gabriel jailhouse. I told Darío and Conejo not to say anything. After the booking rituals, we found out what happened. The first car had come to the house on Marshall Street and opened fire on the bikers who were hanging around. Three bikers went down. Then, a few minutes later, we came by in Darío's ride while the bikers were still figuring out who had gotten injured. Another biker down. The first car escaped. The second car with three teenage male suspects was apprehended and a fired weapon confiscated. Darío, Conejo, and I were booked for assault with intent to commit murder. Chapter 8. They say of the poet and the madman, "We all have a little." Sandra Cisneros. The cells babbled with the poignant tongues of despair licking the walls. Every now and then the air reverberated with gritos, the Mexican yell of a man who's drunk and angry, reaching as deep as he can to shout all his pain and glory to the world. Jail in the barrio is only a prelude. For many homeboys, the walls would soon taste of San Quentin, Folsom, and Soledad, the pathway through the crazy life. From the age of 13 on, I ended up in cells like those of the San Gabriel jailhouse. Places like Pomona, Temple City, East LA, Monterey Park, East Lakes Juvenile Detention Hall, and the LA County jail system following the moratorium. Sometimes the police just held me over 3 nights and then let me go at the start of the week to keep me off the street. But this time, at 17 years old, I faced a serious charge of attempted murder. This time, Mama didn't come for me. "Ese malvado, deje que se pudra," Mama told the Spanish-speaking youth officer after hearing of my arrest. The cell walls were filled with the warrior's art, most of it declaring sangre in the beautiful swirling style of theirs. Smoked outlines of women's faces were burned onto the painted brick. There were love messages. "El loco con la bárbara bebe por vida." And poetry. "Aquí estoy, en la calle sin hando. Nadie sabe mi placa y a nadie le importa. Voy al chante de mi ruca, pero se queda mirando. Le hablo con mi alma, pero la puerta se está cerrando." And, "En el bote del county, con toda mi loca pasión, puse tu placa en la celda, y con ese pensamiento estoy sufriendo mi desgracia." Pachuco Blues. Somebody in another cell let out a solidified grito with the funk of burnt burritos, debris-strewn alleys, and fervent lovemaking thrown into the mix. The holding blocks were made up of two cells and an area for inmates from the shared block to sit around. I gathered up toilet paper, soaked it in water, and rolled it to the size of handballs. When it hardened, I passed the time by throwing it against the wall. A Sangra soldier named Night Owl sat in his cell next to me and threw challenges. Lomas ain't shit, Night Owl said. I heard your homeboy crying. What are you, babies? Fuck you, I answered. You can say that behind thick walls, but I'll be out, and I'll see you in the street. Hours of this opened up into other discussions about family life, about songs we liked. We even shared a few verses, and about women. You know Viviana? I asked. Her brothers are Coyote, Negro, and Shark. What you mean, do I know her? Night Owl said. Everybody knows her. They say she fucked around with some dude on her porch while her brothers were inside watching. Que jodida! It's me they were talking about. Then it struck me as very funny, and I laughed. What are you laughing about? Nothing, man. Whatever happened to her? She got knocked up. She's living with my homeboy Cyclone. A pang of hurt. I shook my head, then changed the subject. Darío, Conejo, and I were scheduled to go to juvenile hall. Our parents refused to get us. It sounded like a conspiracy. Then I received a visitor. You messed up, Luis Chente said. I know. Mama doesn't want anything to do with me. Can you blame her? Not really. Did anyone die yet? There was a dude in serious condition, but he's doing better. One woman lost a couple of fingers. I know why it happened, but why did you have to get involved? I don't know. Something snapped inside of me. I have nothing against bikers, but these were older dudes, man. About 40 years old. They had no business fucking with us. I just couldn't let them get away with it. The center is trying to get you guys released. We talked to your parents and they're willing to work with us. We're doing all we can to help you, but you've got to stay cool. Don't rattle these bars, okay? Chente left. A day later, an officer came and opened my cell. You're getting out. There's people waiting for you. I could see my mom and dad with a couple of Bienvenido staff members in the front desk area. I looked over where Night Owl was still holed up. Hey, dude, here's for Sangra. And I stuck out my hand. Night Owl looked at me for a second, then smirked and shook my hand through the bars. You ain't so bad after all, he said. Suerte ese. The next weeks were stacked with uncertainty about the case. Meanwhile, the people at the mosque welcomed me back at school. I don't know what to say, Louis, Esme said. I'm just glad you're okay. Mrs. Baez saw me in the Chicano Student Center lounge, talking to Blanca and Carmela as I related to them the incident. A clipping with the headline, 5 injured in San Gabriel shootout, had been tacked onto a bulletin board. Luis, R. Joe Astic, a fine example you turn out to be, she said. I'm sorry, Mrs. Baez. I let you down. If you wanted notoriety, you got it. Unfortunately, the younger guys around here think you're God. I didn't mean for this to happen. Nobody ever does, he responded. I have something for you, though. I dropped a folder with papers on her desk. In it were vignettes, poems, and stories. I left as Mrs. Baez picked up the folder and began to peruse it. The bikers refused to identify Darío, Conejo, or me. Instead, they pointed to Roger Nelson. He was there, they said. It was his gun. They saw his stringy long hair as he stuck his head out of a car window. For some reason, they wanted Roger. The police picked up Roger and charged him. Of course, I knew he was in bed the night of the incident. Then another strange thing happened. The authorities let me and the others go. They never did find the first car. They contended only one car was involved and Roger had escaped before the police caught us. What's going on, Chente? I said, while at the youth center. As much as I don't want to get sent up for this, it's all lies. I don't know, but I can tell you this, Chente said. The law isn't always about truth. Instead of being the one facing a hearing, I became the key witness for Roger, who was 18 and had to appear in the adult court. A number of the bikers showed up for the trial, including a woman in a cast and the dude I shot in the butt. The bullet had lodged in mounds of flesh, so no serious damage had been done. Roger wore a suit and now sported a close-cropped haircut. His fiancée, Margarita, sat next to him. This goes way back, Louis, Roger explained. My family had a beef with the Sinisters. Somebody got killed. They always thought my dad did it. He's in the joint now, but they've been after me for years. Since it was my gun, they say I set them up. They want to see me put away, like my dad. I think it's going to backfire on them. I hope so, Roger said. Defense attorneys called me to the witness stand, and I related how I obtained the gun, how I got Darío to drive to the gray house, how there were already people shot when we got there. The bikers got on the stand and flubbed their testimony. There was one car, there were two cars. Mexicans were involved. There were no Mexicans. Most of the arguments made the shootings appear as something only between bikers. I couldn't figure out why. Maybe Puppet had a reason for not wanting us to go back to the gray house the night of the party. A jury found Roger not guilty. Soon after, Roger and Margarita drove to Las Vegas and were married. I went along as their best man. Staff members and volunteers from the area's community centers met to discuss how to end the barrio violence. They stepped into dangerous shifting ground. Police, city officials, even businesses had a stake in this endeavor. We should organize a meeting in which the various groups could agree to a truce, proposed Sal Basuto from La Casa. I don't know if we should condone their existence by doing this, a woman from the Zapopan Community Center countered. We need more police protection. We need to stand up to these hooligans and put them behind bars. That sounds like cops talking, Chente said. These aren't criminals without faces. They are our children. What you propose only pits the community against itself. And the police would like nothing better than that. I think we should treat these youth as adults would treat warring nations, Sal continued. They have to negotiate. They have to draw up treaties. They have to sign them and abide by them. These young people might as well be prepared for the world they're entering. This sounds fine. I don't oppose it offhand, Chente said. But we also must consider how to provide something real and sustainable. Role-playing and game-playing won't make it. These young people need a strong economic foundation, a viable future. If you're not addressing this, then you're not serious about solving anything. I'd been asked to sit in on the meeting, but I didn't say anything at first. I listened. It became important for me to find a way for the barrios to unite. What do you think, young man? One of the staff members asked me during a low point in the talks. I don't know about stopping violence, but it wouldn't hurt if we had jobs. The group decided to have a barrio unity meeting at La Casa. I had to convince my homeboys to show up. Not an easy task. Chicharron agreed to attend. I even tried inviting him to a study session, but he refused. Although in jest, he began calling me the chinmunist, a combination of chin and communist. I walked up and down the hills, talking to dudes about the meeting. The younger guys seemed interested. I got most of the dukes to say they'd come, but I needed some of the locals. My break came with Guerrero. I'm sick of this shit, he confided one day. I've seen too many people killed. Great. I need you to help get others. Órale, Chen. Count me in. One evening, a homeless man tripped over a bundle laid out among bushes at Smith Park in Sangra. He looked closer. A woman's soiled foot stuck out of one end. It was Koki's body, wrapped in bloody blankets. The coroner's office reported she had been pumped full of pills and brutally raped. They had no suspects. But as always, there was talk. Somehow people knew who did what, even when the authorities didn't. The street talk said dudes from Lomas did the job. Koki had long been a thorn in the side of the hills. But it was a crime which scared a lot of us. What were people willing to do? It's true Koki was behind a lot of hurting, but who knows if she deserved the kind of hurting she went through before she died. Chava, just released from Camp Gonzales, a youth detention facility, declared that anybody in Sangra who participated in the Barrio Unity meeting would answer to him. Sal said he needed time to work everything out. He canceled the meeting. The MAS membership leapt off the rolls. I recruited students by going to the lawn and telling them about our activities. A large number of them were there passing the time, scoping each other out, not going to classes. The MAS provided some of them the incentive to break out to do something, even to stay in school. We had brotherhood dances to unite the Chicanos throughout the area. We also sponsored a queen contest to raise funds. Beauty was not a criterion. The winner was the person who could raise more money in a designated period of time. The first year's queen was Amelia, who was short, chubby, not good-looking, but full of spirit and drive. What mattered to us were actions, contributions, essential things. The Anglos still selected their queens on looks and status. Most homecoming queens came from money. When the football season came, Esme and I attended every game as the school's mascots. I remembered a couple of years back when the tradition exploded during a football game, and I pulled dudes off bleachers to beat on them. This time, I stood on the sidelines in Aztec apparel, performing solemn rituals. Change is a mother. Even the varsity team opened up. Ricardo Reyes from the Hills became the school's best running back. Soccer became a school-sponsored sport, and the newly arrived Mexican immigrants were competing in LA area and statewide leagues. The Spanish-speaking students had their own club called ALAS, Association of Latin American Students, which in Spanish means wings. Mrs. Baez was instrumental in creating the soccer team. Although they had no uniforms, no pep rallies, or any school support, the first year they competed, they took the regional championships. One day, pretty Delfina Cortez, the boxer Hector's old girlfriend, came to a Tomas meeting. She looked fine. 14 years old, but shaped like a full-grown woman. She wore skirts and dresses, which seemed to come off the pages of fashion magazines. "You're popular around here," she told me. "I don't know about that. You're the one who's popular." "I mean, Tomas is big right now. People say you had a lot to do with it." "Not any more than Esme, Flora, and the others. Will you join us?" "Sure, as long as you're in it." She smiled and walked away. There must be something to being popular, where somebody like Delfina would have anything to do with a big-jawed, awkward, and long-haired dude like me. The Brotherhood Dance involved students from the three local high schools. We brought in a popular East LA band. Weapons weren't allowed in the gym where the dance was held. We wanted to have a dance in which no one had to fear for their safety. Esme, as president of the club, introduced the members and winners of our contest. Then it was party time. Delfina arrived alone.